This is Keith Law. Welcome to episode 128 of the Keith Law Show. Very excited today. Going to be joined by Susanna Hoffs, who you might know as the lead singer, one of the lead singers of the group The Bangles, which is certainly how I first became a fan. I also enjoy her solo work, and she just put out her first novel, This Bird Has Flown, earlier this year, and that's primarily what we're going to talk about. For those of you who subscribe to The Athletic, I am currently on vacation as I speak these words, but was obviously very happy to make an exception to do this podcast. I have produced quite a bit of baseball content since the last podcast episode. I have broken down pretty much every trade that took place leading up to the trade deadline, certainly if it included prospects, either in an individual column or by contributing a few notes to our news story on the trade. I also did a quick wrap-up just highlighting three teams that I thought had particularly good trade deadlines, three teams that I thought maybe didn't have such great trade deadlines. Did a little piece looking at the three Max Scherzer trades. He's been traded three times in his career, and how those prospect packages differed from one trade to the next. And obviously, prior to that, had a whole bunch of draft content, which was prior to the last podcast episode as well. But I've been writing a lot. I think I wrote more in July maybe than I ever have in any month for The Athletic, and that's why I felt like I could take a few days off. So I am actually speaking these words from a hotel in Indianapolis where I am attending Gen Con, the annual board game convention. So for those of you who follow me for that sort of content, my Gen Con wrap-up will be up at some point early next week over at Paste Magazine, and I've already picked up a few review copies, including Forbidden Jungle, which is the latest co-op game from Matt Leacock, designer of Pandemic. He did Forbidden Island, Forbidden Desert, Forbidden Sky. So I guess this is actually the fourth game in the Forbidden series, which I'm very excited to check out. And I've seen a lot of other great games. I will recap everything I saw for Paste at some point this upcoming week. Now it is my great honor and a bit of a personal thrill to be speaking with Susanna Hoffs, who you might remember from her time as one of the members of The Bangles. She has also had an extensive career as a solo artist with a new album, The Deep End, that just came out about 2 months ago. She also has published her first book, her first novel, called This Bird Has Flown, which came out in the spring. Susanna, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So This Bird Has Flown is your first book of any sort and comes quite a long time into your career as a creative person. So I feel like this might be an obvious question, but did you always want to write fiction, or was this kind of a new something that popped up for you?
A little bit of both. It popped up for me on the heels of having co-written several screenplays over the years. I've always loved fiction in all forms, whether it's within a song, or obviously I'm a book nerd. I've been reading my whole life, and I'm a movie buff. I shouldn't say buff. I'm a movie obsessive. Yeah. And somewhat of a movie buff, I guess you could actually say that. So I have this practice of really going deep and, you know, in all forms, in all genres with movies. But yeah, so it was kind of a lifelong dream, but on the heels of a screenplay, another co-writing situation on a screenplay, kind of finding itself shelved at the studio that had been so interested. And then suddenly, you know, it's the development hell of it all. My older son, Jackson, had said, "Mom, why don't you write that novel you've always wanted to write?" And I thought, why don't I? And then I just sort of took the plunge, and it was an unexpected kind of blissful experience for me. I think it was the right time in my life to do it. I had the time to do it. I made the time to do it. I don't know. It's sort of, the more I think about it, my love of all the different art forms and in different ways that we tell stories and how we connect with each other as human beings, it all kind of swirled together in that right moment for me to take the plunge. And I'm completely self-taught in music, and I don't read music, embarrassingly, but I also didn't take a class or anything. I just found myself studying certain novels that had a big impact on me over my life. And that was really helpful to go back and sort of, instead of just enjoying the story, kind of looking and sort of analyzing the craft of it, you know, of those books.
I understand one of those books is Jane Eyre.
Yes.
And that novel's story at least a little bit inspired This Bird Has Flown, which I didn't know until afterwards. And I started putting it together because I love Jane Eyre also.
Right.
And people often look at me funny when I say that I love that book because it's, you know, sort of this gothic romance novel with this totally ridiculous twist at the end. And although I have to say I also appreciate it more. I don't know if you've ever read The Eyre Affair by Jasper Ford, where he kind of pokes gentle fun.
No, but I'm going to write that
as well.
The Eyre
Affair. Yep.
Okay.
Jasper Ford with two Fs. He has also been a guest on this podcast, as it turns out.
Oh, okay, cool. I have to figure out a way to, maybe at the end I'll get, my phone is not cooperating. I want to write that down. Or you can
Email
me or send it to Nicole or something like that.
Okay, yeah.
But anyway.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Will do. So I'm curious too, what stands out to you about that book, which obviously really stands the test of time, but also was there more from that you took from that, whether it's something direct as sort of the outline of a plot or specific elements or style points that you took from Jane Eyre in writing this book?
Oh, I love that question. Okay. Well, first of all, I love the fierceness of Jane Eyre's character. She's, you know, had a very tough start in life. She is sort of like an orphan, you know, and she was thrown into this sort of boarding school situation that was very difficult with a sort of evil school headmaster, and was living with a family that she didn't really feel comfortable in that setting. And she's just this fierce, she has this indomitable, I hope I didn't stumble over that word, spirit. You know, she's so true to herself. I think that she has this sort of core sense of integrity as a character. And so when she enters this world, this fancy world, this posh setting, and I love the gothicness of it too, because it is not only a romantic book, but it's a gothic story too. You know, it's a kind of an old fashioned kind of story. But that she really has never encountered a man in the form as is Mr. Rochester, who's sort of a flesh and blood, complicated, sort of fiery, intriguing guy. And she holds her own with him in a way. There's that great scene where he invites her to the library and he's very, you know, sort of looking down his nose at her. And she just holds her own in a way. And then she continues to do so throughout the book. And having read it so many times, I had occasion to stumble upon a really excellent audio book version read by Juliet Stevenson, who kindly agreed to read all the British voices in the audio book of This Bird Has Flown, because I realized the level of verbal sparring that the Jane Eyre character has with the Mr. Rochester character is so extraordinary. And it really came through for me in hearing it interpreted through Juliet Stevenson's brilliant narration of that. So there's so many things about it. The book Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier is a similar story with a similar gothic setting of Manderley, and a similar love interest who's like twice her age. And when I say her, it's because bizarrely, you think of the Rebecca, the protagonist is Rebecca. No, the dead wife of Max de Winter is Rebecca. So she's this sort of humble narrator who's like Jane Eyre, is thrown into this very posh setting that's gothic. So I decided to that in my book, knowing that I love the idea of meeting a stranger on a plane, a mysterious stranger on a plane. There's so much about plane flights and stuff, and it all swirls around with my own sort of fear of flying and that theme as well throughout my life, and taking plunges and taking chances into new directions. There's a lot of thematic stuff that I sort of pulled from, especially Jane Eyre. But yeah, I love the Gothic setting also of Rebecca. So those two books kind of feature pretty prominently in my sort of journey of writing This Bird Has Flown.
Oh yeah, I have both excellent choices. I am the real Mrs. De Winter now.
I know.
Oh yeah, fantastic.
It's so great, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, it's fantastic. It is just, it's one of those where I know the movie's great. I understand that. Nothing can beat the turning of the page when you get to that line and the way it just hits, right? Just, yeah. You know, it's as you think, I'd love to write something like the any line that's that powerful, that's that memorable at some point in my life that just smacks people right off the page.
Exactly. And the theme of sort of the ghosts of our past and also... I mean, in both cases, I wanted to reinvent the male protagonist character such an intense degree because, Rochester and Max De Winter are sort of horrible characters, let's face it. I mean,
right.
I having read Jane Eyre so many times, and again, the Juliet Stevenson interpretation of Rochester's dialogue really helped me to see more in Rochester. I think Max De Winter is not much of an appealing character at the end of the day. And it is sad that the unnamed protagonist is sort of, she doesn't have the fierceness of a Jane Eyre character, but I like that Gothic setting. And so I chose Oxford for that reason.
I will say, I think I put Rochester above Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights, though, who I never understand why people like him. He's just terrible.
Terrible.
You know, why is he some sort of romantic character? No, he's just awful.
Yeah, agreed. I'm going to revisit that book as well. Like, there's so many things on my list. It is interesting, though. I don't know. Like, I wish I had a better practice of finding new books, because I do find myself going back to books that I loved in my adolescence. You know, mm-hmm. It's funny. I don't know what that is, but I think some things get imprinted in us as human beings from childhood and adolescence and even college and beyond. But it's, I'm reflecting on that now. And yeah, so it's so fun that you're a fan of those books as well.
I do find that you have to, I need a certain amount of time too. My favorite book in college was a novel called The Master and Margarita.
Oh,
and
I love that one. I want
it's
to
so
note
good.
Of that too.
It's so good.
Okay, thank you.
But I remembered it so well that it's like, I can't read it again. I remember the plot points. I remember the characters. And before I knew it, you know, life goes by, you read other books, and suddenly it was at least 15 years later, probably longer. So, you know, I haven't read that in a really long time, and it was long enough that it was fresh. And of course, you find new things. You're older, you have more life experience.
Well, I just found one from you and made a note of it. The Master and the
There you Bible go. Reader. Yes, and to answer your questions, your question too, is to find out about new books. This is usually it's just by asking people or talking to people, or a reader will recommend something, right?
Totally.
I'll read pretty much anything. Like you, I read all the time.
Yeah, I can't stop. And now that I'm working on a sort of related second book, I shouldn't talk too openly about that because you never know where the story will go. But
sure.
I'm researching a lot of books about Hollywood.
Oh,
is the setting, you know, just to give a little bit mm-hmm. of hints there. But yeah, I love the research phase of things as well. Mm-hmm. It's just so fun to. It is a kind of solo journey, but I found that, I mean, because I've always worked in collaboration or formally worked in collaboration preceding the writing of This Bird. Now I love the research. I love the deep dive into, I mean, I was telling an interview I did recently, the interviewer, that they asked me, how did I grapple with all the British characters? And I said, well, I just spent years watching every episode of Inspector Morse, which is set in Oxford, and mm-hmm. notepad and write scribbling down, you know, the sort of posh, almost over the top ways that the professors would speak, and the characters from the pubs, and you know, just gathering the language because it was so fun, even if it was a bit over the top in Inspector Morse. It was great.
Right, right. So I'm curious about the Jane Stark character too, just sort of what was her genesis? I've seen some interviews where you said it's not really based on you, but she is really interesting. And what I thought was so great, especially for a first time novelist, that you gave us a very three dimensional character. She's very well-rounded. She's smart, yet she's insecure, and she's flawed, but she's not pitiful, right? You're never making fun of her. I never felt like you were making fun of her. You root for, you want to root for this person. And so I'm curious, especially because I feel like that is such a hard thing for even many experienced authors to come up with a really credible three-dimensional character. Where did she come from in your mind?
Yeah. Okay. That's a great question. I mean, when I had that first prompt and I really thought I'm going to open the blank page and start writing this book, I had a moment like, who's the protagonist? And I had a thought about making her an actress. I was originally and automatically driven in my mind for some reason to make her someone who performs for a living and has the pressures that come with that. But then I quickly thought, oh, you know, maybe I should make her a musician, because it is an opportunity for me to take an experience I know so deeply, and I know sort of I could add rich layers to it just from my own experience of being in the music business and being a musician, which are two different things for me. The business is one thing, the love and joy and bliss of making music another. So then once I figured that out, I thought, you know, it would be great to make her a one-hit wonder who's down on her luck, because it's nice to have a predicament to have to grapple with right off the bat. And she's just dumped by a long-term boyfriend, thrown over for a Sports Illustrated model. There's a lot of triggering that happens in a short amount span of time. And her friend and manager, who's British, sort of tries to pull her out of this, you know, downward spiral she's in, and just books her a corporate gig, which is playing a bachelor party in Vegas. And so once I sort of found her there, her voice just started to bloom for me. A combination of like perhaps things that I've experienced myself, having been, you know, felt the heights of being in a really successful band and having hits, but then sort of deafening silence of like it all going away suddenly because the next crop of people in their 20s come along, and she's finding, Jane finds herself at 33 going, oh gosh, I'm over the hill. I've been dumped for a younger woman. I have this one song that was a hit, but does anyone even remember it? And so it made for a good predicament. And then her voice, you know, I found her voice easily. I liked her. I never actually had a very strong idea of what she looked like even. It was just like this whirling dervish, but she's so full of heart, you know, and she's so, no matter how many predicaments she has to encounter along the way that are demoralizing, she'll find somebody to say, well, I'll just pretend I'm at the gyno at a gyno visit. And, you know, it just goes quick. You know, this is going to be over fast, just like that. You dread it, you dread it, you dread it. And then it's like, all right, that's over. Those kinds of things just came into my mind, flooded into my brain for some reason. I thought, and she just would make me laugh. I mean, she was just, I like that. I like that indomitable spirit that she had. And then I wanted her to find love. And I knew the whole time she's just going to be diving into all these things way too fast. But, you know, that's the fun of writing fiction. It's not really you. It's you getting to explore what it would be like to be in somebody else's shoes.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's part of why I love reading fiction too, is just the good fiction, right? Can just transport you into can be experiences that are totally unfamiliar. I read I read all kinds. I read literary fiction. I read genre fiction. I read stuff that's completely foreign to my personal experiences. Doesn't matter. It takes me somewhere totally different. I have to say, too, it's funny. I was going to ask you about the sort of inside baseball parts of the music industry and how you felt, because I personally liked it. I can't speak for anybody else, but having no experience in the music industry at all, I thought it was interesting. I like getting that deep dive. And I was wondering, you've sort of answered this question, but did you worry you were going too far in that direction? Which I don't think you did, but I could see, I'm very familiar with sort of the voices of self-doubt that come into being any sort of writer too. It's like, don't do that. That's too much. That's too much of that. No one's going to think this joke. No one's going to think that's funny.
Yeah.
And so I know I have a little bit of an idea of that feeling.
Yeah. I mean, you do walk kind of a tightrope at times, you know, but speaking specifically to the parts that were about her grappling with her stage fright or her having a you know, loss of confidence in herself and her feeling like she can't do it. Like she's too afraid. She's too, she has too much self-doubt. And it was actually really interesting when I started to write the concert, I don't want to get spoilers. It doesn't matter. But you know, when she finds herself on a big stage, and working through as the writer, all of Jane's feelings as she deals with her stage fright, as she feels her lack of confidence, the level of intimidation she feels having been asked to perform with a true iconic rock star. I know what it's like to stand on a stage and see Freddie from the side of the stage and watch Freddie Mercury perform at Slane Castle in Ireland, where the Bengals had opened, were part of the festival, but we were allowed to watch from the side of the stage. I know, I've seen Robert Plant on a stage, you know, I know what that's like. It's both the most glorious front row seat to something, to be witness to brilliance like that, but it's also insanely intimidating, especially if you're not the kind of artist that really has that swagger. Now, Jane can find it. Like when she turns off all those switches that are telling her, like, you can't do this. Who are you to do this? And she just channels this like singular focus. And when I was writing that part, those parts of the book, you know, once I got readers, you know, on hand to weigh in, and then once I had my fantastic literary agent giving the book, you know, her read, and then Little Brown, you know, is on board with the book, and I have an actual editor. I found that they really loved those parts, and they would encourage me to go even deeper, you know, sometimes. Is if memory serves. I mean, it's been a while since I was in the editing phase, but so that was fun because, you know, I've internalized those experiences. So having to sort of unpack them, you know, in the moment, you know, was really fun and challenging for me. I really liked that. And it was good after being so alone with the book to get eyeballs on it, you know, and to get feedback, because it's different from music. You know, you can kind of go out, and it's always scary when you present a new song. Is anyone going to like that? You know, but you have instant rapport in a sense and feedback from the audience. When you're sitting alone writing a novel in your pajamas most of the time for years, you're like lost in your own fantasy, you know, so you don't really know. So that was really a great, the whole journey of it's been so interesting. And cut to this, like getting up to people who read it, you know, wanting to talk to you about it.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
The last question I had on the book was that rock icon character you mentioned, Jonesy. Are there just little bits of lots of these people? Like, there was one passage I'm blanking because I read it 2 months ago, but there was something that was very Prince in something when he comes out on the stage. I'm like, I bet that's Prince. And obviously you did have recorded a song that Prince had written at one point.
Yeah.
I wondered, was this just bits and pieces? You mentioned a couple of others, any one of whom would intimidate me probably into complete silence if I were standing in front of them. It just seemed like, I know he's a minor character. I think he only actually appears on the page for a tiny section of the book, but he's always there in the background, which seemed like he just seemed fun. Like, you must know all these people with their quirks, and you could pack as much as you felt like into this one character, which makes it all the more exciting for the reader when, you know, mild spoiler, he does appear at some point towards the end of the book. He's not just a phantom.
Yeah, no. I mean, the Jonesy character figures very large in Jane's brain because I mean, just the arc of her being noticed by this. Well, she covers his song. Okay, so that she is there's an inextricable bond between him and her, because she would have no one hit to be the one hit wonder of had it been for her song. And so there's this dynamic that she feels in some ways. Part of it is that she feels like a fraud. Don't we all deign to take the plunge and say, I want to be an artist, you know, in any form. I want to be a novelist in my 50s, you know, and now my 60s. But so I think that he loomed large as a kind of, you know, it just riled up a lot of insecurity in her and fear. And there's a lot of complexity to him as a character too. He's not a character that's easy to read and know and understand. And he's also a kind of character that knows his charisma and uses it. I don't know, in ways that are a little bit nefarious. In that's how I wanted to write it, because I wanted to create this level of predicament for Jane. Like, how do I work with this person, and what does he want from me? You know, and I just know that in the course of my lifetime in the music world, I've experienced that feeling before. You know, and I just thought it would be something to put on the page. And it just gives, not only is Jane grappling with, why am I doing this? Can I write a song? The one song I covered was written by somebody else. Am I worthy of doing this? Can I do it? And so I don't want to give away spoilers, but he factors into that dilemma and journey for her. Yeah.
Transitioning a little bit to talk about your latest album too, which is The Deep End, because that is a covers album. And I sort of also saw a little bit of a parallel to there. And just thinking about your career too, so many of your, not all, but many of your biggest hits, Going Down to Liverpool was a cover. I didn't know that for a very long time, actually. It was probably a good 15 years after that song came out that I discovered it was actually Katrina and the Waves.
I know. For many and people, you did it.
Oh, yeah. You made it popular, certainly in the United States. I think that's the only reason it was popular. And you did a cover of, I've always been fond of The Lightning Seeds, and your cover of All I Want is just an absolute all-time.
I love that. Absolutely recording. Love it. And they are such nice people. That's so cool that you know that one. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Loved their stuff. I was in college when Pure came out, and it was a big college radio hit, right? So had I not been in college at that very specific time too, would I have been as familiar with their work?
I love that.
Yeah, they're so great. And so I was curious too, like, I know this is your second straight album of covers, and I was curious, is that, do you just kind of prefer to work in that at this point in your career? Obviously you haven't always felt that way, or yeah, it occurred to me maybe you're just honoring a lot of songs you really like, too. I know from reading interviews with you, you have pretty broad taste in music, too. And it's a way to bring a lot of those songs to a different audience.
Yes, all of those things. And the Bangles kind of cut their teeth. Is that the expression on doing covers? Like when we first met in the garage of my parents' house where I was living in a converted garage, the first song we ever played together was White Rabbit by the Jefferson Airplane. And in the early Bangles shows, while we were trying to learn how to be, Vicky and I were sort of like a songwriting team. We were trying to figure out how to be a songwriting team. We would just pepper our shows full of covers because what it was there was this Paisley underground movement that sort of bloomed in Los Angeles at that time of like-minded musicians, all of us in our 20s who were sort of trying to drag the 60s music kicking and screaming into the 80s, following new wave and, you know, and punk rock, which I loved too. I was a big Sex Pistols fan, and I saw Patti Smith and the Sex Pistols at Winterland Ballroom in San Francisco when I was a student at UC Berkeley and all that kind of stuff. But so covers were always a big part of the Bangles catalog, as it happens, and our club shows. But you were asking specifically about, about writing versus covering. I mean, I wrote a song yesterday for the first time in years after being so focused on the novel with my friend Steve Tannen, who's in a band called The Weepies. I'm really interested in writing music again. I feel like now that I've written a novel, what's stopping me from actually going back to really trying to write? You know, I co-wrote In Your Room and Eternal Flame with my friends, Billy Steinberg and Tom Kelly. And I did a tremendous amount of writing in the 80s and beyond. But I think something about the music business, there was a little bit of, I don't know, it's a little bit traumatizing. I hate to use such an overblown word because I've had so much success in the, you know, beyond my wildest imagination when I took my flyers to the Whiskey logo and was like, I'm looking for a bandmate pre-internet. You know, like, hello, here's my phone number. After work on weekdays after 5, I have all these flyers that are like, here, there's my phone number and I'm available after 5 p.m. I had a day job.
Right. So, an actual landline for people to call.
Actual landline.
Right.
So I was very tenacious about, you know, starting a band, and I wasn't going to wait. Even if there was American Idol, that wouldn't have been my route. The same with I just want to get something in my head to do it. Like, that's one thing I could say. I really want to do that thing. I'm going to do everything in my power to do it. So that was true for music. But yes, the Bangles relied fairly heavily on covers. And then the big first hit was Beyond, the song Vicky and I did. That was the thing that flagged Prince's attention, which was a co-write with me and Vicky called Hero Takes a Fall, and was our first single, Thank You. I love that song too. That was the song that Prince heard and was like, who's this band? You know, who are these singing that? What is this? And that led to him giving me Manic Monday. I went over to get the, I still have the physical cassette that I got that day. And then we recorded Manic Monday, which he chose to not use his name on, and it's ascribed to an artist called Christopher. But that was classic Prince too, you know, to be sort of evasive or, you know, take on personas. So that was cool. And, I think having written the novel and becoming more comfortable with writing in a way. Oh no, sorry, why did that go away? Oh, there it is, the phone came through there. I thought I had, okay, sorry about that. I've never seen that happen. I'm determined to get back into songwriting, and I'm very excited to do that. I have a little more confidence.
Awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Hero Takes a Fall because, I don't know, 2-3 weeks ago, I went back and watched some of your earlier videos, and it is so funny to watch for folks who haven't seen. So the two videos I think of from that first album, one has Leonard Nimoy as your cab driver, right? Yeah. Going down to Liverpool. Hero Takes a Fall. You guys are so young in that. Video. Like even the difference between that and what it would have been 4 or 5 years, I guess 4 years later to the next album. It's like, oh, this is a brand new band. And you're like playing, it's almost like you're busking on a street corner. Yes, with a lot of hairspray. There was a lot of hairspray involved in those videos.
There was so much. It's so quintessentially, you know, 1984 or something, you know? I have loved revisiting some of that stuff too. It's so funny to see that the changes in the hair and the big 80s hair. And I'm glad you watched that. That was fun. And I loved Leonard Nimoy. I grew up with his kids. So so that was just me. At that point, the label didn't want to make another video. So my mom directed that. And I called Leonard and said, hey, would you be in the video? We just a little bit of stunt casting. And my amazement, he was like, I'll be there. What day? What time? It was so cool.
Amazing. Yeah. I have to say the on the hairspray thing, I know I think your kids are a little older than my oldest is 17. And a year or two ago, she found my high school yearbook. And I'm sure you can imagine what the hairspray situation was like. Lots of pictures where the hair didn't fit, did not actually fit in the frame.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yep. Yeah, no, that was the 80s. When I was in the 80s, when I was living to the 80s, I thought, oh, I wanted it to be more like the 60s. And now I finally have this incredible fascination with the look, the feel, the sounds, the flavors of the 80s. It's just, it's actually a really interesting decade, turns out. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. I've loved introducing my kids to some of the music or movies. Oh, yeah. Not all of the movies, shall we say. Some have not held up quite as well. It's got to be a little selective, but it's fun. It's fun to bring that culture forward to another generation, especially when they're receptive, which all of my kids have been on different levels receptive to that.
That's cool. I remember speaking of the 80s when I was asked to talk to the producer and the composer for Less Than Zero, who were, I was friends with Thomas Newman, who was the composer. And he knew that they wanted to have wall to wall music. And I knew Tommy as a friend, and he brought me over to meet John Avnet, who all these years later, I've maintained a friendship with John, and John and my husband, Jay, worked together as directors and DGA and all kinds of things. But we've known the Avnets, but I remember I pitched Hazy Shade of Winter, which had just been a song that we loved playing in the clubs for the movie. And that was so fun participating in that movie because it was so quintessentially 80s. The Bret Easton Ellis book having adapted, and that movie was really quite, you know, dark and very dark. And the performances, Robert Downey Jr.'s performance in that was unbelievable. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of fun to look back on the 80s. I'm actually really at the time, as I said, I was so much of a 60s nerd. I just wanted to look and sound and be like someone from the 60s. but now I look back on the 80s and I actually love how kitschy it was and quite diverse in the styles of things that were being made in the 80s. I like it. I love the 80s.
Yep. Yep, absolutely. I am very much born in 73, but I always say I'm really more of a child of the 80s in terms of coming of age, especially in terms of
coming of age,
music, film, TV, all of that. I know it still influences me.
Birth of MTV. I recently, not to digress, watched, I can't remember which Andy Warhol documentary it was. It was an Andy Warhol documentary that was so good. It had him painting with Basquiat, Jean-Michel Basquiat. There was like scenes of New York in the 80s. And I was just I was mesmerized by it. I thought, oh, I lived that. I know that the look and feel and sound and vibe of it. So yeah, I'm having a big 80s in my mind. I mean, it's really fun to revisit it.
My guest today has been the multi-talented Susanna Hoffs, whose first novel, This Bird Has Flown, came out earlier this year. I highly recommend it. And her latest album of covers, The Deep End, also came out earlier this summer. Susanna, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show.
That's all for this week's show. Thank you so much for listening.